Problems are problems, she repeated slowly. You have problems, Louisa Clark?
I miss my boyfriend. I said it as much as anything to reassure myself. Apart from that, not really.
This is great. I'm happy here.
She nodded. I used to feel like this.
New York.
Always something to see new. Always exciting. Now I miss... She tailed off. For a moment, I thought her eyes had filled with tears, but then her face stilled.
And you know she hates me.
Who?
Ilaria, the witch. She was the other one's housekeeper, and Leonard will not sack her, so I am stuck with her.
She might grow to like you.
She might grow to put arsenic in my food. I see the way she looks at you. She wishes me dead. You know how it feels to live with someone who wishes you dead?
I was pretty scared of Ilaria myself, but I didn't want to say so. We walked on. I used to work for someone who I was pretty sure hated me at first, I said. Gradually, I worked out that it was nothing to do with me. He just hated his life. And as we got to know each other, we started to get along just fine.
Did he ever scorch your best shirt accidentally? Or put detergent in your underwear that he knew would make your vajayjay itch?
No.
Or serve food that you tell him 50 times you do not like, so you will look like you are complaining all the time. Or tell stories about you to make you seem like a prostitute.
My mouth had opened like that of a goldfish. I closed it and shook my head. She pushed her hair off her face.
I love him, Louisa. But living in his life is impossible. My life is impossible.
Again she tailed off.
We stood, watching the people passing us on the path. The rollerbladers and the kids on wobbling scooters. The couples, arm in arm, and policemen in their shades. The temperature had dropped, and I gave an involuntary shiver in my tracksuit top.
She sighed.
Okay. We go back. Let's see which piece of my favourite clothing the witch has ruined today.
No, I said. Let's get your noodles. We can do that much, at least.
We took a taxi to Gramercy Park, to a place in a brown stone on a shady side street that looked grubby enough to harbour some terrible intestinal bug. But Agnes seemed lighter almost as soon as we arrived. As I paid the taxi, she bounded up the stairs and into the darkened interior. And when the young Japanese woman emerged from the kitchen, she threw her arms around Agnes and hugged her, as if they were old friends. Then, holding Agnes by the elbow, she kept demanding to know where she had been. Agnes pulled off her beanie and muttered vaguely that she had been busy, got married, moved house, never once giving any clue to the true level of change in her circumstances. I noticed she was wearing her wedding ring, but not the diamond engagement ring that was large enough to ensure a triceps workout. And when we slid into the Formica booth, it was like I had a different woman opposite me. Agnes was funny, animated and loud, with an abrupt cackling laugh, and I could see who Mr. Gopnik had fallen in love with.
"So how did you meet?"
I asked, as we slurped our way through scalding bowls of ramen.
"Leonard, I was his masseuse."
She paused, as if waiting for my scandalized reaction. And when it didn't come, she put her head down and continued.
I worked at the St. Regis, and they would send Monsieur to his home every week. Andre, usually. He was very good. But Andre was sick this day, and they asked me to go instead. And I think, oh no, another Wall Street guy. There are so many of them, full of bullshit, you know? They don't even think of you as human. Don't bother saying hello, don't speak. Some they ask for. She lowered her voice. Happy finish, you know, happy finish? Like you are prostitute. Ugh. But Leonard, he was kind. He shake my hand, ask me if I want English tea as soon as I come in. He was so happy when I massage him, I could tell.
Tell what?
That she never touch him. His wife. You can tell, touching a body. She was cold, cold woman.
She looked down.
And he's in a lot of pain some days. His joints hurt him. This is before Nathan came. Nathan was my idea, to keep Leonard fit and healthy. But anyway, I really try hard to make this massage good for him. I go over my hour, I listen to what his body is telling me. And he was so grateful after. And then he asks for me the next week. Andre was not so happy about this, but what can I do? So then I am going twice a week to his apartment. And some days he would ask me if I would like English tea afterwards, and we talk. And then, well, it is hard, because I know I am falling in love with him. And this is something we cannot do. Like doctors and patients. Or teachers. Exactly. Agnes paused to put a dumpling into her mouth. It was the most I had ever seen her eat. She chewed for a moment. But I cannot stop thinking about this man. So sad, and so tender, and so lonely. In the end, I tell Andre he must go instead. I cannot go any more. And what happened? I'd stopped eating. Leonard comes to my home. In Queens. He somehow gets my address, and his big car comes to my home. My friends and I, we are sitting on the fire escape having cigarette, and I see him get out, and he says, I want to talk to you. Like Pretty Woman. Yes, it is. And I go down to the sidewalk, and he is so mad. He say, did I offend you in some way? Did I treat you inappropriately? And I just shake my head. And then he walks up and down, and he say, why won't you come? I don't want Andre anymore. I want you. And like a fool, I start to cry. As I watched, her eyes brimmed with tears. I cry right there in the middle of the day on the street with my friends watching. And I say, I can't tell you. And then he gets mad. Wants to know if his wife was rude to me or whether something has happened at work. And then finally I tell him, I can't come because I like you. I like you very much. And this is very unprofessional. And I can lose my job. And he looks at me for one moment and he says nothing. Nothing at all. And then he gets back in his car and his driver takes him away, and I think, oh no, now I will never see this man again. And I have lost my job. And I go to work the next day, and I'm so nervous, Louisa, my stomach hurts. Because you thought he'd tell your boss exactly this. But you know what happened when I arrive? What? Enormous bouquet of red roses is waiting for me. Biggest I have ever seen, with beautiful velvet-scented roses. So soft you want to touch them. No name on it. But I know immediately. And then every day, a new bouquet of red roses. Our apartment is filled with roses. My friends say they are sick from the smell. She started to laugh. And then on the last day he comes to my house again. And I go down, and he asks me to get in the car with him. And we sit in the back, and he asks the driver to go for a walk. And he tells me he is so unhappy, and that from the moment we met he could not stop thinking about me, and that all I have to say is one word, and he will leave his wife, and we will be together. And you hadn't even kissed? Nothing. I have massaged his buttock, sure, but he's not the same. She breathed out, savoring the memory. And I knew. I knew we must be together. And I said it. I said yes. I was transfixed. That night he goes home and he tells his wife that he does not want to be married anymore. And she is mad. So mad. And she asks him why, and he tells her he cannot live in marriage with no love. And that night he calls me up from hotel and asks me to come meet him. And we are in the suite at the Ritz-Carlton. You stayed at the Ritz-Carlton? No. I walk in and he is standing by the door, like he is too nervous to sit down. And he tells me he knows he is stereotype, and he is too old for me, and his body is wrecked from the arthritis. But if there is a chance, I really do want to be with him. He will do everything he can to make me happy. Because he just has feeling about us, you know? That we are soulmates. And then we hold each other, and finally we kiss. And then we stay awake, all night, talking. Talking about our childhoods, and our lives, and our hopes and dreams. This is the most romantic story I've ever heard. And then we fuck.
Of course.
Oh, my God. I can feel that this man has been frozen for years, you know? At this point, I coughed a piece of ramen onto the table. When I looked up, several people at nearby tables were watching us. Agnes's voice lifted. She gesticulated into the air.
You cannot believe it! It is like your hunger in him. Like all this hunger from years and years is just pulsing through him. Pulsing. That first night, he is insatiable.
Okay, I squeaked, wiping my mouth with a paper napkin.
It is magical, this meeting of our bodies. And afterwards, we just hold each other for hours, and I wrap myself around him. And he lays his head on my breasts, and I promise him he will never be frozen again. You understand?
There was silence in the restaurant. Behind Agnes, a young man in a hooded top was staring at the back of her head, his spoon raised halfway to his mouth. When he saw me watching, he dropped it with a clatter.
That's a really lovely story. And he keeps his promise. Everything he says is true. We are happy together. So happy.
Her face fell a little. But his daughter hates me. His ex-wife hates me. She blames me for everything. Even though she did not love him, she tells everyone I am a bad person for stealing her husband. I didn't know what to say. And every week I have to go to these fundraisers and cocktail evenings and smile and pretend I do not know what they are saying about me. The way these women look at me. I am not what they say I am. I speak four languages. I play piano. I did special diploma in therapeutic massage. You know what language she speaks? Hypocrisy. But it is hard to pretend you have no pain, you know? Like you do not care.
People change, I said hopefully.
Over time?
No, I don't think it's possible.
Agnes's expression was briefly wistful. Then she shrugged.
But, on bright side, they are quite old. Maybe some of them will die soon.
That afternoon I called Sam when Agnes was taking a nap and Ilaria was busy downstairs. My head was still swimming with the previous evening's events and Agnes's confidences. I felt as if somehow I had moved into a new space. I feel like you are more my friend than my assistant, she had told me as we walked back to the apartment. It is so good to have somebody I can trust.
I got your pictures, he said.
It was evening there and Jake, his nephew, was staying over. I could hear his music playing in the background. He moved his mouth closer to the phone.
You looked beautiful.
I'll never wear a dress like that again in my life. But the whole thing was amazing. The food and the music and the ballroom. And the weirdest thing is, these people don't even notice it. They don't know what's around them. There was one entire wall made of gardenias and fairy lights. Like a massive wall. And there was the most amazing chocolate pudding, a fondant square with white chocolate feathers on it, and tiny ruffles on the outside. And not one woman ate hers. Not one. I walked the whole way around the tables, counting just to check. I was tempted to put some of the truffles in my clutch bag, but I thought they might melt. I bet they just threw the whole lot away. Oh, and every table had a different decoration. But they were all made of yellow feathers, and shaped like different birds. We had an owl.
Sounds like quite an evening.
There was this one barman who could make cocktails based on your character. You had to tell him three things about yourself, and then he would create one.
Did he make one for you?
No, the guy I was talking to got a salty dog, and I was afraid I'd get a corpse reviver or a slippery nipple or something, so I just stuck with champagne.
Stuck with champagne? What do I sound like?
So who were you talking to? There was just the slightest pause before he said it. And to my annoyance, just the slightest pause before I responded. Oh, just this guy, Josh. A suit. He was keeping me and Agnes company while we waited for Mr. Gottlieb to come back.
Another pause.
Sounds great. I started to gabble now. And the best bit is, you never even have to worry about how to get home because there's always a car outside. Even when they just go to the shops, the driver just pulls up outside, then waits or drives around the block and you walk out and ta-da! There's your big black shiny car. Climb in. Put all your bags in the boot. Except they call it a trunk. No night bus. No late night tube with people puking on your shoes. The high life, eh? You won't want to come home. Oh, no. It's not like it's my life. I'm just a hanger-on. But it's quite something to see up close. I have to go, Lou. Promised Jake I'd take him out for a pizza. But we've hardly spoken. What's going on with you? Tell me your news. Some other time. Jake's hungry. Okay. My voice was too high. Say hi to him for me. Okay. I love you, I said. Me too. One more week. Counting the days. Gotta go. I felt strangely wrong-footed when I put the phone down. I didn't quite understand what had just happened. I sat there motionless on the side of my bed, and then I looked at Josh's business card. He had handed it to me as we left, pressing it into my palm and closing my fingers around it. Give me a call. I'll show you some cool places. I had taken it and smiled politely, which of course could have meant anything at all. Chapter 7 Fox's Cottage, Tuesday, 6th of October. Dear Louisa, I hope you are well and enjoying your time in New York. I believe Lily is writing to you, but I was thinking after our last conversation, and I had a look in the loft and brought down some letters of Will's from his time in the city that I thought you might enjoy. You know what a great traveller he was, and I thought you might enjoy retracing his footsteps. I read a couple myself, a rather bittersweet experience. You can keep hold of them until we next see each other. With fondest wishes, Camilla Traynor. New York, 12th of the 6th, 2004. Dear Mum, I would have called, but the time difference doesn't really fit around schedules here, so I thought I'd shock you by writing. First letter since that short-lived stint at Priory Manor, I think. I wasn't really cut out for boarding school, was I? New York is pretty amazing. It's impossible not to be infused by the energy of the place. I'm up and out by 5:30 every morning. My firm is based on Stone Street, down in the financial district. Nigel fixed me up with an office, not corner, but a good view across the water. Apparently, these are the things by which we are judged in NY. And the guys at work seem a good bunch. Tell Dad that on Saturday I went to the opera at the Met with my boss and his wife. Der Rosenkavalier, bit overdone. And you'll be happy to hear I went to a performance of Le Liaison Dangereuse. Lot of client lunches, lot of company softball. Not so much in the evenings. My new colleagues are mostly married with young children, so it's just me and trawling the bars. I've been out with a couple of girls, nothing serious. Here they seem to date as a pastime. But mostly I've just spent my spare hours at the gym and hanging out with old friends. Lot of people here from Shipman's, and a few I knew at school. Turns out it's a small world after all. Most of them are quite changed here, though. They're tougher, hungrier than I remember. Think the city brings that out in you. Right, off out with Henry Farnsworth's daughter this evening. Remember her? Leading light of the Stortfold Pony Club. Has reinvented herself as some sort of shopping guru. Don't get your hopes up. I'm just doing it as a favour to Henry. I'm taking her to my favourite steakhouse on the Upper East Side. Slabs of meat the size of Gaucho's blanket. I'm hoping she's not vegetarian. Everyone here seems to have some sort of food fad going on. Oh, and last Sunday I took the F train and got off on the far side of the Brooklyn Bridge just to walk back across the water, as you suggested. Best thing I've done so far. Felt like I'd stepped into an early Woody Allen movie. You know, the ones where there was only a 10-year age gap between him and his leading ladies. Tell Dad I'm calling next week and give the dog a hug from me. Love, W. Kiss. With that bowl of cheap noodles, something had changed in my relationship with the Gopniks. I think I grasped a little better that I could bolster Agnes in her new role. She needed someone to lean on and to trust. This, and the strange osmotic energy of New York, meant that from then on, I literally bounced out of bed in a way that I hadn't done since working for Will. It caused Ilaria to tut and roll her eyes, and Nathan to view me sideways as if I might have started taking drugs. But it was simple. I wanted to be good at my job. I wanted to get the absolute most out of my time in New York, working for these amazing people. I wanted to suck the marrow out of each day, as Will would have done. I read that first letter again and again, and once I'd got over the strangeness of hearing his voice, I felt an unexpected kinship with him, a newcomer to the city. I upped my game. I jogged with Agnes and George every morning, and some days I even managed to last the entire route without wanting to throw up. I got to know the places that Agnes's routines took her to, what she was likely to need to have with her, and where, and bring home. I was ready in the hallway before she was there, and had water, cigarettes, or green juice ready for her almost before she knew she wanted them. When she had to go to lunch where the awful matrons were likely to be, I would make jokes beforehand to shake her out of her nerves, and I would send her cell phone gifts of farting pandas or people falling off trampolines to pick up during the meal. I was there in the car afterwards, and listened to her when she told me tearfully what they had said or not said to her, nodded sympathetically or agreed that, yes, they were impossible mean creatures, dried up like sticks, no heart left in them. I became good at maintaining my poker face when Agnes told me slightly too much about Leonard's beautiful, beautiful body and his many, many beautiful skills as a lover, and I tried not to laugh when she told me Polish words, such as kolenica, with which she insulted Ilaria without the housekeeper understanding. Agnes, I discovered quite quickly, had no filter. Dad always said I used to say the first thing that came into my head, but in my case it wasn't bitter old whore in Polish, or can you imagine that horrible Susan Fitzwalter getting waxed would be like scraping the beard off a closed muscle. Brr! It wasn't that Agnes was mean per se. I think she felt under such pressure to behave in a certain way, to be seen and scrutinized and not found wanting, that I became a kind of safety valve. The moment she was out of their company, she would swear and curse, and then by the time Gary had driven us home, she would have recovered her equanimity in time to see her husband. I developed strategies to reintroduce a little fun into Agnes's life. Once a week, without putting it into the diary, we would disappear to the movie theatre on Lincoln Square in the middle of the day to watch silly, gross-out comedies, snorting with laughter as we shoveled popcorn into our mouths. We would dare each other to go into the high-end boutiques of Madison Avenue and try on the worst designer outfits we could find, admiring each other straight-faced and asking, "Do you have this in a brighter green?" while the sales assistants, one eye on Agnes's Hermes Birkin bag, fluttered around, forcing compliments from the sides of their mouths. One lunchtime, Agnes persuaded Mr. Gopnik to meet us, and I watched as, posing like a catwalk model, she paraded a series of clown-like trouser suits in front of him, daring him to laugh, while the sides of his mouth twitched with suppressed mirth. "You are so naughty," he said to her afterwards, shaking his head fondly. But it wasn't just my job that lifted my spirits. I had started to understand New York a little more, and in return it had started to accommodate me. It wasn't hard in a city of immigrants, outside the rarefied stratosphere of Agnes's daily life. I was just another person from a few thousand miles away, running around town, working, ordering my takeout, and learning to specify at least three particular things I wanted in my coffee or sandwich, just to sound like a native. I watched, and I learnt. This is what I learnt about New Yorkers in my first month. 1. Nobody in my building spoke to anyone else, and the Gopnik spoke only to a shook. The old woman on the second floor, Mrs. DeWitt, didn't talk to the couple from California in the penthouse, and the power-suited couple on the third floor walked along the corridor with their noses pressed to their iPhones, barking instructions to the microphone or at each other. Even the children on the first floor, beautifully dressed little mannequins, shepherded by a harried young Filipina, didn't say hello, but kept their eyes on the plush carpet as I walked past. When I smiled at the girl, her eyes widened as if I had done something deeply suspicious. The residents of the lavery walked straight out and into identikit black cars that waited patiently on the curb. They always seemed to know whose was whose. Mrs. DeWitt, as far as I could see, was the only person who spoke to anyone at all. She talked to Dean Martin constantly, muttering under her breath as she hobbled around the block about the wretched Russians or those awful Chinese from the building behind ours, who kept their own drivers waiting outside 24/7, clogging up the street. She would complain noisily to a shook or the building's management about Agnes playing the piano, and if we passed her in the corridor, she would hurry by, occasionally letting slip a vaguely audible tut. 2. In contrast, in shops, everyone talked to you. The assistants followed you round, their heads tilted forward as if to hear you better, always checking to see whether there were any way they could serve you better, or whether they could put this in a room for you. I hadn't had so much attention since Trina and I had been caught shoplifting a Mars bar from the post office when I was 8, and Mrs. Barker shadowed us, like an MI5 operative, every time you went in there for sherbet dibdabs for the next 3 years. And all New York shop assistants wanted you to have a nice day, even if you were just buying a carton of orange juice or a newspaper. At first, encouraged by their niceness, I responded, "Oh, well, you have a nice day too." And they were always a little taken aback, as if I simply didn't understand the rules of New York conversation. As for Ashok, nobody passed the threshold without exchanging a few words with him. But that was business. He knew his job. He was always checking you were okay, that you had everything you needed. "You can't go out in scuffed shoes, Miss Louisa." He could pull an umbrella from his sleeve like a magician for the short walk to the curb, accepting tips with the discreet sleight of hand of a card huckster. He could pull dollars from his cuffs, discreetly thanking the traffic cop who smoothed the way of this grocery driver, or that dry-cleaning delivery, and whistle a bright yellow taxi out of thin air with a sound only dogs could hear. He was not just the gatekeeper to our building, but its heartbeat, keeping things moving in and out, ensuring that everything went smoothly, a blood supply around it. 3. New Yorkers. Those who didn't take limos from our apartment building walked really, really fast, striding along sidewalks and dipping in and out of crowds, as if they had those sensors attached that automatically stop you bumping into other people. They held phones or styrofoam coffee cups, and before 7 a.m. at least half of them would be in workout gear. Every time I slowed, I heard a muttered curse in my ear or felt someone's bag swing into my back. I stopped wearing my more decorative shoes, the ones that made me totter, my Japanese geisha flip-flops or my 70 stripy platform boots, in favour of sneakers, so that I could move with the current instead of being an obstacle that parted the waters. If you had seen me from above, I like to think you would never have known that I didn't belong. During those first weekends, I walked too, for hours. I had initially assumed that Nathan and I would hang out together exploring new places, but he seemed to have built a social circle of blokey men, the kind who really had no interest in female company, unless they had sunk several beers first. He spent hours in the gym, and topped each weekend off with a date or two. When I suggested we go to a museum, or perhaps to walk the High Line, he would smile awkwardly and tell me he already had plans. So I walked alone, down through Midtown to the meatpacking district, to Greenwich Village, to Soho, veering off main streets, following whatever looked interesting, my map in my hand, trying to remember which way the traffic went. I saw that Manhattan had distinct districts, from the towering buildings of Midtown to the achingly cool cobbled roads around Crosby Street, where every second person looked like a model or as if they owned an Instagram feed devoted to clean eating. I walked with nowhere in particular to go, and nowhere I had to be. I ate salad at a chopped salad bar, ordering something with cilantro and black beans, because I'd never eaten either of them. I caught the subway trying not to look like a tourist as I fathomed how to buy a ticket and identify the legendary crazies, and waited 10 minutes for my heart rate to return to normal when I emerged back into daylight. And then I walked across the Brooklyn Bridge, as Will had done, and felt my heart lift at the sight of the glinting water below, feeling the rumble of the traffic beneath my feet, hearing once again his voice in my head. "Live boldly, Clark." I stopped halfway across and stood very still as I gazed across the East River, feeling briefly suspended, almost giddy with the sense of no longer being tied to any place at all. Another tick, and slowly I stopped ticking off experiences, because pretty much everything was new and strange. On those first walks I saw a man in full drag riding a bicycle and singing show tunes through a microphone and speakers. Several people applauded as he rode past. 4 girls playing jump rope between 2 fire hydrants. They had 2 ropes going at once, and I stopped to clap when they finally stopped jumping, and they smiled shyly at me. A dog on a skateboard. When I texted my sister to tell her, she told me I was drunk. Robert De Niro. At least I think it was Robert De Niro. It was early evening, and I was feeling briefly homesick, and he walked past me on the corner of Spring Street and Broadway, and I actually said, "Oh, my God, Robert De Niro," out loud before I could stop myself, as he walked past. And he didn't turn round, and I couldn't be sure afterwards whether that was because he was just some random who thought I was talking to myself, or whether that was exactly what you would do if you were Robert De Niro, and some woman on the sidewalk started bleating your name. I decided the latter. Again, my sister accused me of being drunk. I sent her a picture from my phone, but she said, "That could be the back of anyone's head, you doofus," and added that I was not just drunk, but genuinely quite stupid. It was at that point that I started to feel slightly less homesick. I wanted to tell Sam this. I wanted to tell him all of it, in beautiful handwritten letters, or at least in long, rambling emails that we would later save and print out, and that would be found in the attic of our house when we had been married 50 years for our grandchildren to coo over. But I was so tired those first few weeks that all I did was email him about how tired I was. "I'm so tired. I miss you."
"Me too."
No, like, really, really tired. Like, cry at TV advertisements and fall asleep while brushing my teeth and end up with toothpaste all over my chest tired.
"Okay, now you got me."
I tried not to mind how little he emailed me. I tried to remind myself that he was doing a real hard job saving lives and making a difference, while I was sitting outside manicurist studios and running around Central Park. His supervisor had changed the rota. He was working 4 nights on the trot and still waiting to be assigned a new permanent partner. That should have made it easier for us to talk, but somehow it didn't. I would check in on my phone in the minutes I had free every evening, but that was usually the time he was heading off to begin his shift. Sometimes I felt curiously disjointed, as if I had simply dreamt him up. 1 week, he reassured me. 1 more week. How hard could it be? Agnes was playing the piano again. She played when she was happy or unhappy, angry or frustrated, picking tumultuous pieces high in emotion, closing her eyes as her hands roved up and down the keyboard and swaying on the piano stool. The previous evening she had played a nocturne, and as I passed the open door of the drawing room, I'd watched for a moment as Mr. Gopnik sat down beside her on the stool. Even as she became wholly absorbed in the music, it was clear that she was playing for him. I noted how content he was just to sit and turn the pages for her. When she'd finished, she'd beamed at him, and he had lowered his head to kiss her hand. I tiptoed past the door, as if I hadn't seen. I was in the study, going over the week's events, and had got as far as Thursday, Children's Cancer Charity Lunch, Marriage of Figaro, when I became aware of a rapping at the front door. Ilaria was with the pet behaviourist. Felix had done something unmentionable in Mr. Gopnik's office again, so I walked out to the hallway and opened it. Mrs. DeWitt stood in front of me, her cane raised as if to strike. I ducked instinctively, and then, when she lowered it, straightened, my palms raised. It took me a second to grasp. She had simply used it to rap on the door. "Can I help you?"
"Tell her to quit that infernal racket!"
Her tiny etched face was puce with fury. "I'm sorry?"
"The masseuse. The mail order bride. Whatever. I can hear it all the way down the corridor."
She was wearing a 1970s Pucci-style duster coat with green and pink swirls and an emerald green turban. Even as I bristled at her insults, I was transfixed. Agnes is actually a trained physical therapist. And it's Mozart?
"I don't care if it's Champion the Wonder Horse playing the kazoo with his you-know-what. Tell her to pipe down. She lives in an apartment. She should have some consideration for other residents."
Dean Martin growled at me as if in agreement. I was going to say something else, but trying to work out which of his eyes was actually looking at me was weirdly distracting. "I'll pass that on, Mrs. DeWitt," I said, my professional smile in place.
"What do you mean, pass it on? Don't just pass it on. Make her stop. She drives me crazy with the wretched pianola, day, night, whenever. This used to be a peaceful building."
"But, to be fair, your dog is always back."
"The other one was just as bad. Miserable woman. Always with her quacking friends. Quack, 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 in the corridor. Clogging up the street with their oversized cars. Ugh. I'm not surprised you traded her in."
"I'm not sure, Mr. Gopnik."
"Trained physical therapist. Good Lord, is that what we're calling it these days? I suppose that makes me chief negotiator at the United Nations.
She patted her face with a handkerchief. "As I understand it, the great joy of America is that you can be whatever you want to be," I smiled. She narrowed her eyes. I held my smile.
"Are you English?"
"Yes." "Why? Do you have relatives there, Mrs. DeWitt?"
"Don't be ridiculous."
She looked me up and down.
"I just thought English girls were meant to have style."
And with that, she turned, and with a dismissive wave, hobbled off down the corridor, Dean Martin casting resentful glances behind her.
"Was that the crazy old witch across the corridor?" Agnes called as I closed the door softly. "Ugh, no wonder nobody ever comes to see her. She is like horrible dried-up piece of Shusorni Dosh."
There was a brief silence. I heard pages being turned. And then Agnes started a thunderous cascading piece, her fingers crashing on the keyboard, hitting the pedal so hard that I felt the wood floors vibrate. I fixed my smile again as I walked across the hallway and checked my watch with an internal sigh. Only 2 hours to go. Chapter 8. Sam was flying in that day and staying until Monday evening. He had booked us into a hotel a few blocks from Times Square. Given what Agnes had said about how we shouldn't be apart, I had asked if she might give me part of the afternoon off. She had said, "Maybe," in what I felt was a positive tone, although I got the distinct feeling that Sam coming for the weekend was an irritation to her. Still, I walked to Penn Station, a bounce in my step, and a weekend bag at my heels, and caught the AirTran to JFK. By the time I got to the airport, slightly ahead of time, I was buzzing with anticipation. The arrivals board said Sam's flight had landed and that he was awaiting his luggage, so I hurried into the ladies to check my hair and makeup. A little sweaty from the walk and the packed train, I touched up my mascara and lipstick and swiped at my hair with a brush. I was wearing turquoise silk culottes with a black polo neck and black ankle boots. I wanted to look like myself, but also as if I had changed in some indefinable way, perhaps become a little more mysterious. I dodged out of the way of an exhausted-looking woman with an oversized wheelie case, gave myself a little spritz of perfume, then finally judged myself the kind of woman who meets her lover at international airports. All the same, as I walked out, heart thumping, and peered up at the board, I felt oddly nervous. We had been apart only 4 weeks. This man had seen me at my worst, broken, panicked, sad, contrary, and still apparently liked me. He was still Sam, I told myself. My Sam. Nothing had changed since the first time he had rung my doorbell and asked me, ham-fistedly through the intercom, for a date. The sign still said, "Awaiting luggage." I wedged myself into position at the barrier, checked my hair again, and trained my eyes on the double doors, smiling involuntarily at the shrieks of happiness as long-separated couples found each other. I thought, "That'll be us in a minute." I took a deep breath, noting that my palms had started to sweat. A trickle of people made their way through, and my face kept settling into what I suspected was a slightly mad-looking rictus of anticipation. Eyebrows raised, delighted like a politician, fake spotting someone in a crowd. And then, as I rummaged in my bag for a handkerchief, I did a double take. There, a few yards away from me in the mass of people, stood Sam, a head taller than anyone around him, scanning the crowd, just as I was. I muttered, "Excuse me," to the person on my right at the barrier, ducked under it and ran towards him. He turned just as I got to him and promptly whacked me hard in the shin with his bag.
"Oh, shoot. Oh, are you okay, Lou? Lou?"
I clutched my leg, trying not to swear. Tears had sprung to my eyes, and when I spoke it came through a gasp of pain.
"It said your luggage wasn't through," I said, teeth clenched.
"I can't believe I missed our great reunion. I was in the loo."
"I came hand luggage only."
He put his hand on my shoulder.
"Is your leg okay?"
"But I had it all planned. I had a sign and everything." I wrestled it, specially laminated, out of my jacket, and straightened, trying to ignore the throbbing in my shin. World's handsomest paramedic. "This was meant to be one of the defining moments of our relationship. One of those moments you look back on and go, 'Oh, do you remember that time I met you at JFK?'"
"It's still a great moment," he said hopefully. "It's good to see you." Good to see me.
Great. It's great to see you. Sorry, I'm knackered. I didn't sleep.
I rubbed my shin. We stared at each other for a minute.
It's no good, I said. You have to go again.
Go again?
To the barrier. And then I'll do what I planned, which is hold up my sign, then run towards you and we kiss and we start it all properly.
He stared at me.
Seriously?
It'll be worth it. Oh, go on, please.
It took him a moment longer to confirm that I wasn't joking. Then he began to walk against the tide of arrivals. Several people turned to stare at him and somebody tutted.
Stop!
I yelled across the noisy concourse. That'll do! But he didn't hear me. He kept walking all the way to the double doors. I had a fleeting fear that he might just jump back on the plane.
Sam! I yelled. Stop!
Everyone turned. Then he turned and saw me. And as he started to walk towards me again, I ducked back under the barrier.
Here, Sam! It's me!
I waved my sign, and as he walked towards me, he was grinning at the ridiculousness of it all. I dropped the sign and ran towards him, and this time he didn't bash me in the shin, but let his bag fall at his feet and swept me up, and we kissed like people do in the movies, fully and with absolute joy, and without self-consciousness or fears about coffee breath. Or perhaps we did. I couldn't tell you. Because from the moment Sam picked me up, I was oblivious to everything else. To the bags and the people and the eyes of the crowds. Oh, God, but the feel of his arms around me. The softness of his lips on mine. I didn't want to let him go. I held on to him and felt the strength of him around me and breathed in the scent of his skin. And I buried my face in his neck, my skin against his, feeling like every cell in my body had missed him.
Better, you insane person, he said, when he finally pulled back so that he could see me properly. I think my lipstick may have been halfway across my face. I almost definitely had stubble rash. My ribs hurt where he was holding me so tightly.
Oh, yes, I said, unable to stop grinning. Much. We decided to drop our bags at the hotel first, me trying not to gabble with excitement. I was talking nonsense, a stream of disjointed thoughts and observations coming out of my mouth unfiltered. He watched me, the way you might look at your dog if it did an unprompted dance, with faint amusement and vaguely suppressed alarm. But when the lift doors closed behind us, he pulled me towards him, took my face in his hands and kissed me again.
"Was that to stop me talking?" I said when he released me.
"No, that was because I wanted to do that for 4 long weeks, and I plan to do it as many times as I can until I go home again."
"That's a good line. Took me most of the flight."
I gazed at him as he fed the key card into the door and for the 500th time marvelled at my luck in finding him when I'd thought I could never love anyone again. I felt impulsive, romantic, a character in a Sunday afternoon movie.
And here we are.
We stopped in the doorway. The hotel room was smaller than my bedroom at the Gopniks, carpeted in a brown plaid in the bed, rather than the luxurious expanse of white fret linen I had envisaged, was a sunken double with a burgundy and orange checked bedspread. I tried not to think about when it might last have been cleaned. As Sam closed the door behind us, I set down my bag and edged around the bed until I could peer through the bathroom door. There was a shower and no bath, and when you put the light on, the extractor whined like a toddler at a supermarket checkout. The room was scented with a combination of old nicotine and industrial air freshener.
"You hate it." His eyes scanned my face.
"No, it's perfect."
"It's not perfect. Sorry. I got it off this booking website when I just finished a night shift. Want me to go downstairs and see if they have other rooms?"
I heard her saying it was fully booked.
"Anyway, it's fine. It has a bed and a shower, and it's in the middle of New York.
And it has you in it, which means it's all wonderful." "Oh, crap. I should have run it past you."
I never was any good at lying. He reached for my hand and I squeezed his. "It's fine, really." We stood and stared at the bed, and I put my hand over my mouth until I realized I couldn't not say the thing I was trying not to say.
"We should probably check for bedbugs, though."
"Seriously?
There's an epidemic of them, according to Ilaria."
Sam's shoulders sagged.
"Even some of the poshest hotels have them."
I stepped forward and pulled back the covers abruptly, scanning the white sheet before stooping to check the mattress edge. I moved closer.
Nothing, I said. So that's good. We're in a bed-bug-free hotel.
I gave a small thumbs up.
Yay!
There was a long silence. Let's go for a walk, he said. We went for a walk. It was at least a great location. We strolled half a dozen blocks from 6th Avenue and back up 5th, zigzagging and following where the urge took us, me trying not to talk endlessly about myself or New York, which was harder than I thought, given that Sam was mostly silent. He took my hand in his, and I leant against his shoulder and tried not to sneak too many glances at him. There was something unexpectedly odd about having him there. I found myself fixing on tiny details, a scratch on his hand, a slight change in the length of his hair, trying to reclaim him in my imagination. "You've lost your limp," I said, as we paused to look in the window of the Museum of Modern Art. I felt nervous that he wasn't talking as if the terrible hotel room had ruined everything. "So have you."
"I've been running," I said. "I told you. I go around Central Park every morning with Agnes and George, her trainer. Here, feel my legs."
Sam squeezed my upper thigh as I held it towards him and looked suitably impressed.
"You can let go now?"
I said when people started to stare.
"Sorry," he said. "It's been a while."
I had forgotten how much he preferred to listen than talk. It took a while before he offered up anything about himself. He finally had a new partner, after 2 false starts, a young man who decided he didn't want to be a paramedic, and Tim, a middle-aged union rep who apparently hated all mankind. Not a great mindset for the job. He had been paired with a woman from North Kensington Station who had recently moved house and wanted to work somewhere closer to home.
"What's she like?"
"She's not Donna," he said. "But she's okay. At least she seems to know what she's doing."
He had met Donna for coffee the week previously. Her father was not responding to chemotherapy, but she had disguised her sadness under sarcasm and jokes, as Donna always did.
"I wanted to tell her she didn't have to," he said. "She knows what I went through with my sister, but..."
He looked at me sideways.
"We all cope with these things in our own ways."
"Jake, he told me, was doing well at college. He sent his love. His dad, Sam's brother-in-law, had dropped out of grief therapy, saying it wasn't for him, even though it had stopped his compulsive bedding of strange women. He's eating his way through his feelings now, put on a stone since you left."
"And you?"
"Oh, I'm coping."
He said it simply, but it caused something in my heart to crack a little.
"It's not forever," I said as we stopped.
"I know.
And we're going to do loads of fun stuff while you're here."
"What have you got planned?"
Basically, it's you getting naked, followed by supper, followed by more you getting naked. Maybe a walk around Central Park, some corny tourist stuff like the Staten Island Ferry in Times Square, and some shopping in the East Village, and some really good food with added you getting naked.
He grinned.
"Do I get you getting naked too?"
"Oh yeah, it's a 2-for-1 deal."
I leant my head against him. "Seriously though, I'd love you to come and see where I work, maybe meet Nathan and Ashok and all the people I go on about. Mr. and Mrs. Gopnik will be out of town, so you probably won't meet them, but you'll at least get an idea of it all in your head."
He stopped and turned me to face him. "Lou, I don't really care what we do, as long as we're together."
He coloured a little as he said it, as if the words had surprised even him.
"That's quite romantic, Mr. Fielding." "I tell you what, though, I need to eat something pretty fast if I'm going to fulfil this getting naked bit. Where can we get some food?"
We were walking past Radio City, surrounded by huge office buildings.
"There's a coffee shop," I said.
"Oh, no," he said, clapping his hands together. "There's my boy. A genuine New York food truck."
He pointed towards one of the ever-present food trucks, this one advertising stacked burritos. "We make 'em any way you like 'em." I followed him and waited while we ordered something that appeared to be the size of his forearm and smelt of hot cheese and unidentified fatty meat.
"We didn't have plans to eat out tonight, right?"
He wedged the end into his mouth. I couldn't help but laugh. "Whatever keeps you awake. Though I suspect that's going to put you in a food coma."
"Oh, God, this is so good. Want some?"
I did, actually, but I was wearing really nice underwear and I didn't want bits of me hanging over the top. So I waited until he'd finished it, noisily licking his fingers, then tossing his napkin into the bin.
He sighed with deep satisfaction.
Right, he said, taking my arm,
and everything felt suddenly blissfully normal.
About this naked thing.
We walked back to our hotel in silence. I no longer felt awkward, as if the time apart had created some unexpected distance between us. I didn't want to talk any more. I just wanted to feel his skin against mine. I wanted to be completely his again, enfolded, possessed. We headed down 6th Avenue, past the Rockefeller Center, and I no longer noticed the tourists that stood in our way. I felt locked into an invisible bubble, all my senses trained on the warm hand that had closed around mine, the arm that crept around my shoulder. His every movement felt heavy with intent. I was almost breathless with it. I could live with the absences, I thought, if the times we spent together felt as delicious as this. We were barely in the lift when he turned and pulled me to him. We kissed, and I melted, lost myself in the feel of him against me, my blood pulsing in my ears so that I barely heard the lift doors open. We staggered out.
"Door thing," he said, patting his pockets with some urgency. "Door thing, where did I put it?"
"I've got it," I said, wresting it out of my back pocket.
"Thank God," he said,
as he kicked the door shut behind us, his voice low in my ear.
"You have no idea how long I've been thinking about this."
2 minutes later, I was lying on the burgundy bedspread of doom, sweat cooling on my skin, wondering whether it would be really bad if I reached down to get my knickers. Despite the bedbug checks, there was still something about this cover that made me want a barrier between it and any part of my bare body. Sam's voice floated into the air beside me.
"Sorry," he murmured. "I knew I was pleased to see you, but not that pleased."
"It's fine," I said, turning to face him. He had this way of pulling me into him, like he was gathering me up so that I was totally enclosed. I had never understood women who said a man made them feel safe, but that was how I felt with Sam. His eyes were drooping, battling sleep. I calculated it was around 3 in the morning for him now. He dropped a kiss on my nose.
"Give me 20 minutes and I'll be good to go."
I ran my finger lightly along his face, tracing his lips, and shifted so that he could pull the covers over us. I placed my leg over his so that there was almost no part of me not touching him. Even that movement caused something in me to ignite. I don't know what it was about Sam that made me unlike myself, without inhibition, full of hunger. I was not sure I could touch his skin without feeling that reflexive internal heat. I could glance over at his shoulders, the heft of his forearms, the baby-soft dark hairs where his neck became his hairline, and I would feel almost incandescent with lust.
"I love you, Louisa Clark," he said softly.
20 minutes, hmm?" I said, smiling, and hooked him in tighter. But he dropped into sleep like someone stepping off a cliff. I watched him for a while, wondering whether it would be possible to wake him, and what means I might employ to do it. But then I remembered how disorientated and exhausted I had been when I'd arrived. And then I thought of how he'd just done a week of 12-hour shifts, and that it was only a few hours into our whole 3 days together. With a sigh, I released him and flopped onto my back. It was dark outside now, the sounds of the distant traffic floating up to us. I felt a million things and was disconcerted to find that one was disappointment. "Stop," I told myself firmly. My expectations for this weekend had simply risen like a souffle, too high for sustained contact with the atmosphere. He was here, and we were together, and in a few hours we would be awake again. "Go to sleep, Clark," I told myself. I pulled his arm over me, inhaling the scent of his warm skin, and closed my eyes. An hour and a half later, I was lying on the far side of the bed, scrolling through Facebook on my phone, marvelling at Mum's apparently infinite appetite for motivational quotes and photographs of Tom in a school uniform. It was 10:30, and sleep was uninterested in stopping by. I climbed out of bed and used the bathroom, leaving the light off so that Sam wouldn't be woken by the screeching fan. I hesitated before climbing back in. The sagging mattress meant that Sam had tipped gently into the middle, leaving me a few inches on the edge, unless I pretty much lay on top of him. I wondered idly if an hour and a half sleep was enough. And then I climbed in, slid my body against his warm one, and after a moment's hesitation, I kissed him. Sam's body came too before he did. His arm pulled me in, his big hand sliding the length of my body, and he kissed me back. Slow, sleep-filled kisses that were tender and soft and made my body arch against his. I shifted so that his weight was on me, my hand seeking his, my fingers linking with his, a sigh of pleasure escaping me. He wanted me. He opened his eyes in the dim light and I looked into them, heavy with longing, noting with surprise that he had already broken into a sweat. He gazed at me for a moment. "Hello, handsome," I whispered. He made as if to speak, but nothing came out. He looked off to the side, and then suddenly he clambered off me. "What?" I said. "What did I say?" "Sorry," he said. "Hold on." He bolted for the bathroom, hurling it shut behind him. I heard an, "Oh, God," and then sounds that for once I was grateful that the screeching extractor fan largely obscured. I sat there, frozen, and climbed out of bed, pulling on a T-shirt. "Sam?" I leant into the door, pressing my ear against it, then backed away. Intimacy, I observed, could only survive so much in the way of sound effects. "Sam? Are you okay?"
"Fine,"
came his muffled voice. He was not fine. "What's going on?" A long gap. The sound of flushing.
I think I may have food poisoning.
"Seriously? Can I do anything?"
"No, just don't come in, okay?"
This was followed by more retching and soft cursing. "Don't come in." We spent almost 2 hours like that. Him locked in some awful battle with his internal organs on one side of the door, me sitting anxiously in my T-shirt on the other. He refused to let me check on him. His pride, I think, forbade it. The man who finally came out, shortly before 1 o'clock, was the colour of putty, with a Vaseline glaze. I scrambled to my feet as the door opened and he staggered slightly, as if surprised to see me there. I reached out a hand, as if I had any hope of stopping someone his size falling. "What shall I do? Do you need a doctor?"
"No, just gotta sit this one out."
He flopped onto the bed, panting and clutching his stomach. His eyes were ringed with black shadows and he stared straight ahead. Literally. "I'll get you some water," I stared at him. "Actually, I'm going to run to a pharmacy and get you some Dyrolite or whatever they have there." He didn't even speak, just toppled onto his side, staring straight ahead, his body still damp with sweat. I got the required medication, offering up silent thanks to the city that didn't just not sleep, but offered rehydration powders too. Sam chugged one down, and then, with an apology, retreated to the bathroom again. Occasionally, I would pass a bottle of water through a gap in the door, and in the end, I turned on the television.
"Sorry,"
he muttered when he stumbled out again shortly before 4. And then he collapsed onto the bedspread of doom, and fell into a brief, disjointed sleep. I slept for a couple of hours, covered with the hotel robe, and woke to find him still asleep. I showered and got dressed, letting myself out silently so that I could grab a coffee from the machine in the lobby. I felt bleary. At least, I told myself, we still had 2 days to go. But when I walked back into the room, Sam was in the bathroom again.
"Really sorry,"
he said when he emerged. I had pulled the curtains, and in daylight he looked, if anything, greyer against the hotel sheets. Dark shadows under his eyes.
"I'm not sure I'm up to much today."
"That's fine," I said.
"I might be okay by this afternoon," he said.
"Fine."
"Maybe not the ferry trip, though. Think I don't want to be anywhere where there are communal loos."
"I get it." He sighed.
"This is not quite the day I had in mind."
"It's fine," I said, climbing onto the bed beside him.
"Will you stop saying it's fine?"
he said irritably. I hesitated a moment, stung, then said icily, "Fine." He looked at me from the corner of his eye.
"Sorry."
"Stop apologizing." We sat on the bedspread, both looking straight ahead. And then his hand reached across for mine.
"Listen,
he said eventually. I'm probably going to have to hang here for a couple of hours. Try and get my strength back. Don't feel you have to sit with me. Go shopping or something. But you're only here till Monday. I don't want to do anything without you. I'm good for nothing, Lou. He looked like he could have punched a wall, if only he'd had the strength to raise a fist. I walked 2 blocks to a newsstand and bought an armful of newspapers and magazines. I then bought myself a decent coffee and a brown muffin, and a plain white bagel for when he might want to eat something. Supplies, I said, dropping them on my side of the bed. Might as well just burrow in. And that was how we spent the day. I read every single section of the New York Times, including the baseball reports. I put the Do Not Disturb sign on the door, watched him dozing, and waited for colour to return to his face. Maybe he'll feel better in time for us to have a walk in daylight. Maybe we could grab a drink in the hotel bar. Sitting up would be good. Okay, so maybe he'll be better tomorrow. At 9:45, when I turned off the television chat show, pushed all the newspapers off the bed, and burrowed down under the duvet, the only part of my body still touching his was my fingers, entwined with his at the tips. He woke feeling a little brighter on Sunday. I think by then there was so little in his system that there was nothing left to come out. I bought him some clear soup, and he ate it tentatively, and pronounced himself well enough to go for a walk. 20 minutes later we jogged back and he locked himself into the bathroom. He was really angry then. I tried to tell him that it was okay, but that just seemed to make him angrier. There's not much that's more pathetic than a 6'4" man mountain trying to be furious while he can barely lift a glass of water. I did leave him for a bit then, because my disappointment was starting to show. I needed to walk the streets and remind myself that this wasn't a sign, it didn't mean anything, and that it was easy to lose perspective when you'd had no sleep, and had been stuck for 48 hours with a gastrointestinally challenged man and a bathroom with deeply inadequate soundproofing. But the fact that it was now Sunday left me heartbroken. I was back at work tomorrow, and we had done none of the things I'd planned. We hadn't gone to a ball game, or on the Staten Island ferry. We hadn't climbed to the top of the Empire State, or walked the High Line, arm in arm. That night we sat in bed, and he ate some boiled rice I had picked up from a sushi restaurant, and I ate a grilled chicken sandwich that tasted of nothing. "On the right track now," he murmured, as I pulled the cover over him. "Great," I said. And then he was asleep. I couldn't face another evening of scrolling through my phone, so I got up quietly, left him a note, and headed out. I felt miserable and oddly angry. Why had he eaten something that had given him food poisoning? Why couldn't he make himself better quicker? He was a paramedic, after all. Why couldn't he have picked a nicer hotel? I walked down Sixth Avenue, my hands thrust deep into my pockets, the traffic blaring around me, and before long I found myself headed towards home. Home. With a start, I realized that was how I now thought of it. A shook was under the awning, chatting to another doorman who moved away as soon as I approached. "Hey, Miss Louisa, aren't you meant to be with that boyfriend of yours?" "He's sick," I said. "Food poisoning." "You're kidding me. Where is he now?"
"Sleeping." I couldn't face sitting in that room for another 12 hours. I felt suddenly, oddly close to tears. I think Ashok could see it because he motioned me to come in. In his little porter's room, he boiled a kettle and made me a mint tea. I sat at his desk and sipped it, while he peered out now and then to make sure Mrs. DeWitt wasn't around to accuse him of slacking. "Anyway," I said, "why are you on duty? I thought it was the night guy."
"He's sick, too. My wife is super mad at me right now. She's meant to be at one of her library meetings, but we don't have anybody to look after the kids. She says if I spend one more of my days off here, she's going to have a word with Mr. Ovitz herself. And nobody wants that." He shook his head. "My wife is a fearsome woman, Miss Louisa. You do not want to upset my wife."
I'd offer to help, but I think I'd better go back and check on Sam.
"Be sweet," he said as I handed him his mug. "He came a long way to see you, and I can guarantee he is feeling way worse than you are right now."
When I got back to the room, Sam was awake, propped up on pillows and watching the grainy television. He looked up as I opened the door. I just went for a walk. I
couldn't face one more minute stuck in here with me.
I stood in the doorway. His head was sunk into his shoulders. He looked pale and unutterably depressed.
Lou, if you knew how hard I'm kicking myself.
It's fa- I stopped myself just in time. Really, I said. We good. I ran him a shower, made him get in and washed his hair, squeezing the last out of the tiny hotel bottle, then watched the suds slide down the huge slope of his shoulders. As I did, he reached up, took my hand silently, and kissed the inside of my wrist softly. A kiss of apology. I placed the towel over his shoulders, and we made our way out to the bedroom. He lay back on the bed with a sigh. I changed out of my clothes and lay down beside him, wishing I didn't still feel so flat.
"Tell me something about you that I don't know," he said.
I turned towards him.
"Oh, you know everything. I'm an open book. Come on, indulge me."
His voice was low against my ear. I couldn't think of anything. I still feel really oddly annoyed about this weekend, even though I know that's unfair of me.
"Okay," he said, when it was clear I wasn't going to speak. "I'll start then. I am never eating budget airline food again."
"Funny." He studied my face for a moment. When he spoke again, his voice was unusually quiet.
"And things haven't been easy at home."
"What do you mean?"
It took a minute before he spoke again, as if he wasn't sure even then if he should. "It's work. You know, before I got shot, I wasn't afraid of anything. I could handle myself. I guess I reckon I was a bit of a tough guy. Now, though, what happened is at the back of my mind all the time."
I tried not to look startled. He rubbed at his face.
"Since I've been back, I find myself assessing situations as we go in, differently, trying to work out exit routes, potential sources of trouble, even when there's no reason to."
"You're frightened?"
"Yeah, me."
He laughed dryly and shook his head.
"They've offered me counselling. Oh, I know the drill from when I was in the army. Talk it through, understand it's your mind's way of processing what happened. I know it all. But it's disconcerting."
He rolled onto his back.
"To tell you the truth, I don't feel like myself."
I waited.
"That's why it hit so hard when Donna left, because I knew she'd always look out for me."
"But this new partner will look out for you, surely. What's her name?"
"Katie."
"Katie will look out for you. I mean, she's experienced, and you guys must be trained to take care of each other, right?" His gaze slid towards me. "You won't be shot again, Sam. I know you won't." Afterwards,